Court. Hello, everyone. I'm Leslie Cornwell, certified nurse midwife with Midwifery Business Consultation. I'm very excited about our guest today, Barbara Cass Rothman. I was recommended by an amazing midwife to talk with her. She is a sociologist that I believe is internationally known. She has dozens and dozens of books. We were joking before the recording of in the birth space, all these wonderful resources she's gotten out, and we'll definitely talk about her newest book. So, Barbara, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
So, Barbara, tell me a little bit about your backdrop, how you got into the birth space and your journey, and then we'll dive into some of the subjects you're so near and dear to your heart.
I was a sociology doctoral student. This, we're talking back in the 70s. I was very interested in the sociology of knowledge and the social construction of reality. How do we know what we know? There's so much that people feel is just obvious, but yeah, how do you know that? And that was the theoretical perspective that I was bringing to the world. I was 26. We'd been married for 5 years. At that point in time, that was delayed childbearing. I was the oldest first-time pregnant woman I knew. And I wanted a home birth for personal reasons. My father had died when I was a kid. He died in the hospital. It did not look like a fun, safe place to me. And they did some basic research, and they were saying, "Oh, hospital's so much better because you can have oxygen available." My grandma had an oxygen tank in the in our bedroom. Like, come on. So I kind of looked through it. I was living in a city. If we needed a section, the car would be parked outside. Like, what was the big deal? So I tried to talk an obstetrician into helping me because I didn't even know anything about midwives. I got hung up on by a lot of people. "You're trying to kill your baby, chunk." There was one woman who was Marcia Storch, who had worked with the Jane Collective doing illegal abortions. And the woman's right to choose argument was kind of, yeah,
Very
that
interesting.
worked. So she'd never done or seen a home birth. She suggested I go to, there were nurse midwives at a hospital in New York, and so she suggested I go there. And I was like, "No, that's not the point. I want to know." So she ended up doing a home birth. So while I was laboring, my sociology mind was a little bit still going, never turned off. And how much, I loved this woman. I valued her. She's passed a long time ago. I am not trying to diss her or put her down. But bless her, she had no clue what she was doing. I labored on a full bladder, which I didn't understand till like a decade later that that caused certain problems. Because Hesh, my husband, and I had practiced bathroom modesty, as some people do. And I didn't have 2 minutes to say, "Heshy, come to the bathroom with me," which he would have, but whatever. So I never said, "Oh, yeah, I gotta pee." When the baby was born and I reached out, she wanted my. Need to give birth on a bed, raised up because she had a bad back. So we did all that. But I was laboring in a rocking chair and she was like, "Actually, just lean back." So she ended up catching the baby in a rocking chair, which she had never done. And I reached out for the baby and she went like this to where there should be a nurse. And my mother was standing there. So, this is not tragic and I'm really not trying to dump on this
Yeah,
woman.
but these little
But
things have a ripple effect when you remember it
it wasn't
forever.
even about the effects, whatever. Okay. But looking at it later, I realized she didn't know that much. She didn't know anything about home birth. She knew about how birth works in hospitals. Well, is that knowing about birth or is that knowing about hospital birth? So I started looking at it intellectually. I started doing more research. Long story short, did a dissertation in which I interviewed literally every midwife of whatever stripe who in the greater New York area was doing home births. Most of those were nurse midwives who a friend said, "Okay, I'm giving birth at home and either you come or I'm alone." So they like, ugh. Or a few who had read about the home birth movement and got kind of interested. Ina May hadn't yet published that book. It was still early days on midwifery home. A few were midwives who had started in other places in England and the Caribbean and were finding themselves doing hospital births, saying, "What the hell?" I remember one midwife who had worked in home settings all her life, working in America for the first time. And one day there was a woman who was thirsty, but they wouldn't let you give her a drink of water or whatever. So she's hooked to an IV and then she couldn't move. And, 3 hours later, she's watching the woman being wheeled down to the operating room for a cesarean. And she said, I could have just given her some apple juice. And she said, I need to get out of here. And so she started doing home births. So what I was looking at was this shift between what I was first thinking of as the hospital and the home setting. And very much it is about hospital and home. But I also watched how Marcia Storch kind of brought the hospital setting into the home. And I watched how some of these midwives brought the home setting into the hospital, trying to block the door physically to give the woman 5 more minutes. I mean, there were some really interesting things, lying about when she achieved full dilation. Not lying, but don't examine her. She's
Conservative
almost
numbers, yes,
dilated.
yeah, the
Not
conservative
examine
numbers. You learn to play the game,
her.
yeah.
So all of that. So I started comparing these two ways of thinking, and that was my sociology of knowledge. And I said, no, let's not call it home and hospital. Let's call it a medical and a midwifery approach. And I don't know if you know this, but there's some famous work that was done in the world of knowledge and sociology and theory of Thomas Kuhn about paradigm switches. He said, science isn't just another fact, another fact, another fact. So, but at some point, people go, oh, right, stop and reframe. And so I realized I was seeing a paradigm shift, but these were practitioners, not theorists. So I said, don't call it paradigm. And I remember a phone conversation that went on forever with another graduate student. We tried to figure out how to name it. And so I said, midwifery model and medical model. As you know, that phrase midwifery model went on. At some point, someone said to me, that you named that. And I said, oh, that's, oh, actually, oh, yeah, I did. I remember the day. So calling it the midwifery model, I think, was helpful in people who are trying to make that paradigm shift. When you name something, people can think about it. If something doesn't have a name, it's really hard to think and talk about it and develop it. So I feel like that was my major contribution in many ways, was just seeing that shift. It wasn't just that midwives be nicer, which is what the medical people say. If you want just somebody nice and hold your hand, okay, we got doulas. It's nice to have somebody who's nice. But skills and knowledge and experience and craft are what matter. And that's what the midwives had in a model that the obstetricians did not. So that's where I started.
Yeah, it's amazing just to even hear, even nowadays, the midwives that are trying to fill both hats, like you're talking about in the 70s. Like, I think we all have our challenges and stories of situations where you're trying to fit both worlds. You're trying to, okay, the hospital setting isn't the best for you, but maybe it's difficult to do the home setting in your area. But like, if we're seeing more and more the training of the medical version of midwifery, particularly nurse midwives, because a lot of the schools with malpractice insurance, they can't do birth centers, they can't do homes, and certified professional midwives are getting the advantage of seeing the midwifery model compared to the nurse midwives. I'm seeing more and more of a dyad of experience and how the practice of midwifery is being interpreted.
Right. And they're starting to understand about the notion of two different models or paradigms.
So I would love to hear, you've got dozens of books. Your most recent book that is coming out or just published, it sounds like.
It's not like a year already,
Okay, it's been out a year.
the
Okay.
biomedical empire.
Okay. Perfect.
That's
The Biomedical Empire. So I would love for you to expand on what that book is about and what made you decide to write that one.
Well, it's a concept I've been thinking about for a long time that medicine is obviously one of the largest businesses on the planet. I mean, that's a given. And we could debate whether it is the largest or not, but it's big. It also has, if you think about what an empire, the Roman Empire, the British Empire, think about it. Obviously, mega business. But also, what we call governmentality, an authority to rule. What they say is true. I mean, think about birth certificates. You need a medically verified signature, or you don't exist. And trans people are talking about how you need medical approval for their sex, but every baby needs medical approval for sex. You don't exist as female if some medical person didn't write female on your birth certificate. And you're not dead if you're not declared dead. If you haven't seen Grandpa in a week and you break into his house and find his rotting, drippy mess of a dead body corpse on the bed, do not invite the family and create a funeral in the backyard. You'll be in more trouble than you can imagine. You need to medically declare. That is governmentality, that and a million other places. You want to skip your final exam, get a doctor's note, whatever. I mean, medical approval. So governmentality. And empires usually have a belief that what they're doing, and people come to believe, is a higher kind of power, a kind of a belief. And if I had a nickel for every time I heard somebody say they believe in chemo or they believe in whatever medical thing. So it has these elements. And I think one of the things that's really important to think about is empires didn't only rule by taking land. They took knowledge. So take one example. What the hell is going on with those goats on that mountain? They're like crazy. They're wild. What is that? And the people say, oh, yeah, they're eating those beans, coffee beans. Well, oh, caffeine, it works. So how does that work? And the people had to explain, well, you pick the beans at a certain time, and here's how you roast them, and here's how you grind them, and here's how you make a drink out of it. That is all over the planet. That was knowledge that was colonized. What we've seen in the world of medicine, what we've seen specifically in the world of midwifery, is the colonization of knowledge. You can be accused of practicing medicine without a license if you say somebody's pregnant and they walk in with a belly. That's practicing medicine without a license. So the availability of the right to use your knowledge has been taken over in what I'm calling an empire. One of the ways of thinking about this is like right now, in the last year or so, I've seen a few articles which just, I don't want to laugh or cry, but say, oh, well, Caesar couldn't have been born by cesarean section because his mother was alive and he was an adult. Like, are you kidding me? We know that people have done cesareans or surgically moved. These are by midwives forever. And yes, mother and baby survived sometimes. To think that the people who butchered the meat, turned it, the men went and killed it and then handed it to the women, and who made jackets out of the hide, couldn't figure out that when the baby wasn't coming out this
The
way, wait,
anatomy.
I got a knife, there's another plan. I know how to sew, there's another plan. But medicine so colonized that knowledge that people are genuinely thinking that it was invented by a surgeon, or it's only safe when done by a surgeon. We know there are midwives in, we've seen them lately, who've been doing with, using banana wine in parts of Africa and helping women get through cesarean sections with no medical anything. So the colonization of knowledge is really an important part of the biomedical empire. People who are not in the United States often tell me, so I'm in Finland or Holland or wherever, they say, oh yeah, in America it's a business, but not here. It's like, yes, sweetie, you're not paying for it. But if there was one chocolate factory on planet Earth, just one, and every country bought three pieces for each person every month or something, in Finland, every person would get their chocolate. In America, you'd have people with rotting chocolate in the basement, and kids who said, ooh, I've heard of chocolate. I'd love to taste some someday. Would the chocolate factory care? You're selling the same chocolate. So if you guys pay for it collectively or we pay for it individually, it doesn't make it not an industry. It doesn't make it not the world's largest or almost largest, depending on how you count, industry. So I started thinking about this years ago, working with my colleague Alan Peterson in Australia, and whatever. We started thinking about medicine as an empire. And that is never to say it doesn't do good. Romans built some amazing walls. The British stopped Indians from burning widows on funeral pyres. I'm in favor of those things. I'm also in favor of surgery to remove an inflamed appendix. I dislocated my jaw a while ago. Nobody around here knows how to fix it at 1 in the morning. I'm glad there's an open all-night place that could get the jaw back in. So I'm not saying get rid of medicine, but the imperial power that it wields and the way it's a business, it systematically cuts us off from knowledge, from care, from services that we could use. So anyway, I was told it was too radical a concept for a medical sociology textbook. Literally, Ellen and I were going to do a textbook. Oh, too radical. And then COVID. So I ended up, it's a short book. I really like this because like 150 pages cost $15. It's not one of these tomes you have to get through. So it's one of the Stanford Briefs. So it's a university press, but I don't write university style, in the vernacular. And I was able to lay it out, and people could see it with COVID because you could see in a worldwide response. And so people were able to understand a little bit of what I was saying.
How much
I was
everything is centralized. The centralized planning. I love macroeconomics, and I love the looking at the bigger systems, part of my personality and the big vision thinking. Like when I've been trying to figure out how do we change the maternity healthcare system and shift over abundancy of midwifery, you and I are very similar. We're like, we look at the big systems, we look at history, we look at the different angles, we look at and trying to figure out the variable root causes so we can empower, we can make at least awareness of them on a larger scale.
It's structural. I mean, that's what sociologists see is the structure. And I mean, some of us are more comfortable seeing structure. When I was a kid, and how I became a sociologist, when I was a kid, I had this idea that if ambulances carried little cans of red paint, and every time there was a car crash or a pedestrian hit by a car, they just took 2 seconds, not even. Dump the red paint on the spot. If there were a bunch of red paint spots in one area, you'd stop saying, "Look carefully before crossing the street." And I'd say, "Wait, what the hell?" And you'd look at the area. That's structural thinking. When you look at the US, you could say, "Oh, that nasty doctor did that, and that woman went there, and that," all the individual variables that end up with lousy outcomes. Or you could say, "Hey, if this country has lousier outcomes than other countries, what's going on structurally?" And stop always blaming all the individuals for their probably whatever, sometimes good, sometimes bad, but constrained decisions.
They're
So exactly.
multifaceted variables to have that individual situation that are infected. I'm trying to think of the word affected by this, the bigger system that's that Swiss cheese effect causing that individual scenario. And yeah, I was thinking about that. I've been doing locum assignments for the Indian Health Reservation the last couple of years, and it's interesting, like just seeing when you're very fortunate to look and at things in multiple perspectives and angles, like the level of okay, this happened right now, but people aren't looking five levels up because of the scenario of the training or the culture or the leadership or the funding and the resources available. Like there's just so many mass, they just look at the very specific piece and then they're wondering why they can't put the puzzle together. So Barbara, with your experience, I would love to hear, have you seen like shifts to better or the worse the last 40, 50 years, or is it more just cyclical where you're like, oh, it's getting a little better and then it gets a little worse? Or I would love your perspective of evolution with the healthcare system and maternity care.
Okay, I don't use the language of healthcare system when I'm talking about medical services. Health would be air quality, water quality, space to move around, food quality, things that make people healthy. That's not what you go to a hospital for. That's not what you go to a doctor's office for. It's not about health. And I think we both know it's mostly not about care. It's about the provision of services. So you're talking about medical services, not health care. And I say that so often that friends, students, whatever, will say, "Health care, I mean medical services." But I think it's an important concept.
No, I agree.
My
Until we get a
industry.
paradigm shift, until we get a mindset that you're really differentiating, this isn't healthcare, even though you're told to label it that way. What is the definition of healthcare?
People will literally say, "Does she have health care?" And what they mean is, "Does she have medical insurance?" Insurance for a medical procedure is not remotely health care,
Makes sense.
but it's obviously in the interest of the industry the empire, whatever you want to call it, to have us think that way.
Makes
So,
total sense.
what I've seen, let's specifically talk around birth. When I started in this in the 70s, the cesarean section rate was what, 5%, 6%, maybe 7%. It's like a third now, just in the States. So I think that's worth noting that we made all this progress, and the cesarean section went from 7 women out of 100, maybe, to 30 something women out of 100, and higher in some places, and not a lot lower many places. So I think that's noteworthy. That's a change. I think it's worth noting that obstetrics is a surgical specialty. And you know that line, to a man with a hammer, a person with a hammer, everything looks like a nail. If you're a surgical specialist, what do you think was going to happen? The other thing is that in that first book I did, and early on, and in this the book I did, Recreating Motherhood, I tried to understand the larger concepts that were defining how we were understanding it. One of them was the idea of patriarchy. In every culture, men rule. I give up. I don't care. I don't know. I'm not going to try to understand that. But in some, they rule as the headman of the mother's family, so they're her older brother. In some, they rule as father. In Christian, Judeo traditions, Muslim traditions, God the Father, the children are the children of Abraham. Women are the place you plant the baby. The baby exists in the man and is planted in the woman. So men rule as fathers. In that logic, they literally, one of the first uses of the microscope was to see the homunculus, the little man, the little person curled up in the head of the sperm. If you believe something's there, you can see it. They discovered the egg, oops, and decided, okay, babies are half his and half hers. And might as well have grown in the backyard. I mean, if it's half his and half hers, what are you talking about? So the logic of patriarchy is that the fetus is the patient. They'll talk about moving a high-risk woman. They'll talk about moving the fetus inside you. The woman is the place that we move the fetus in. Accessing the fetal patient through the maternal barrier. Yeah, we're the barrier to fetal care. And so that has only gotten, when that's your mindset, look at the technology we've developed. We can get right past the woman. We can see the fetus. You can see it floating around there really early on. Everybody posts their ultrasounds on the refrigerator and on Facebook. The existence of the woman is erased. When I do a talk, I'll say, just doodle me, with a live audience. Remember, we used to do this? I'll say, doodle a fetus in the air. And so they do the big head and the curled up body and say, okay, now put the woman's belly button on it. Because actually, she's on her head. Because most babies, this isn't head up. So we've erased the woman politically, in every which what way, intellectually. And that has changed systematically because you develop the technology that you think you need. And what you need is to get past the maternal barrier and access the fetal patient. So that has changed. It's not disconnected, I don't think, from the cesarean section. The idea that your patient baby is in there and we can't really get at it properly now. So sure, let's cut you open and get to the true patient here. That's the kind of changes I've seen. It's not, yeah, this goes up and down a little bit, that goes up and down a little bit, but the direction has been towards more and more the construction of the fetus as the patient. It has consequences. Roe was never a woman's right to choose. It was a decision between a woman and her doctor. That's what's written in that. So it was never about women anyway. But as the fetal patient has become more and more a powerful cultural image, you can see why Roe got overturned also. I see these things as connected. It's not just, oh yeah, this goes up and down a little bit. But there's a structural component here that the ideology of patriarchy, that the seed is the person, and then you just plant it somewhere. In English, The word that we use, if you have a seed and you want to take it to your garden, you dig a hole in the what? Give me the word. Dig a hole in the
Ground, you put just, yeah, you implant it, yeah.
ground is a good one. Most often people say the dirt or the soil.
Okay.
Women are the dirt and the soil. And we never think in the land of, planting seeds, we talk about all of the powers in the seed, and the soil can somehow be less than perfect.
Right,
But
which
we
makes sense.
rich earth springing forth with life in this culture. We talk about wonderful seeds planted in the dirt. So ground is a good word, but it's not the most typical response. Probably not disconnected from your own underlying thinking. So yeah, I think we are structurally, intellectually, and then economically in this model. COVID threw in some interesting moments that allowed people to see it. The isolation of the patient. It was clear that we do not give a damn about you as a person or your people that matter, whatever. We're treating your kidney or your fetus or your whatever body part we're treating. That was how medicine started with hospitals. They used to not allow parents in to see children. That was the rule. You isolated a kid in the hospital, it was so much easier to work with. If the parents came and visited when the parents left, the kids were maniacs screaming for mommy. Give them, 5, 6 hours, and they're just totally traumatized lying there, and you can do whatever you want to them. And it was much easier. COVID, in a way, just brought that back. We don't need all these people. Get everybody out. We call the person who runs down the hall changing bags the caregiver, and your mother or your husband or your aunt or whoever who comes in and knows what you need and takes care of you, that's the visitor. So that medical model of the surgical patient as this barrier to its own care, really, right? You're the battleground.
Right.
Just get rid of all the social you can. It flourished in COVID, and people could see it.
Yeah. Well, and I think, I mean, there's so many examples going through my head as you're talking, just life experiences, and there's very different paradigms of some people want to see it and some people don't want to see it, and it's like, oh, this is the excuses of, well, this is just unknown circumstances, and I'm like, no, we've hit another pivotal shift, and I don't think we're going to go back to more autonomy. I mean, there's most hospitals, even though the COVID restrictions and the culture shift of the pandemic is still very much present. It's very much there, and how do we get that back? Is it possible? And then other people are saying, well, I community-based medicine or community-based medical services are going through the roof because people are looking for alternatives. They're looking for their eyes have opened and they're not going back to.
Yeah, but do you remember early in, I don't know if you remember this story, but relatively early in the pandemic, and I'm sorry, I don't remember where, somewhere in the country, a man had a gangrenous foot that needed to be amputated. And he had a doctor, and the doctor said, "Look, we go in there, you're getting COVID, let's just do this on my back porch." And he set up a sterile thing, and he set up that, and he did what he needed to do. The doctor was in more trouble. I don't know if he still got his license. The world came down on him like crazy. This is the empire fighting back. We can see as clear as a bell that if you put a whole bunch of weak people in a single spot, we had to invent the word nosocomial infections. Insight, hospital-based infections. We had the word iatrogenic, medical error, medical damage, medical whatever. But that the institution itself kills people. We knew that. We saw it with newborns. We saw it with old people. And did we say, "Oh, okay, then we're just going to get rid of those nursing homes and start"? No. During COVID, yes, we saw how quickly people died in the nursing homes, but they've been doing that a flu for the last 100 years. Did you notice? But now it became a thing. You could see better. But when they gave, early vaccines for the most important frontline workers, stay-at-home caregivers of sick people, whether it was a parent with a child or a child with a parent, they were not eligible. They were not essential workers. People who were paid by the industry, they're essential workers. We'll give them access to the shot. But you left your job because you're somebody you love is deathly ill and you are taking care of them. Yeah, good luck with that. Okay, next.
Makes sense. Yeah.
So it did not threaten the empire or threaten the institutions. No, we used it to consolidate the institutions.
Yeah, no, I wholeheartedly agree. And particularly in midwifery, have you seen a dyad of like increased access to midwifery in the bigger medical services, or have you seen more of a focus shift with the obstetrical maternity services that are being offered the last couple of years? Have you noticed anything with that in your studies?
I have not specifically done the kind of research,
Okay.
and it's happening in a few places, but it really hasn't been done properly yet. We don't really know, certainly, the long-term consequences. So on the one hand, we are seeing people say, so actually, why would I want to put grandpa in the hospital to die? And why would I want to go in there to give birth when it's like the infection hotbed of the planet? And so we've seen some of that. We haven't necessarily seen, actually, why did we ever do that? We're not seeing so much of that. So we've got to get those hospitals asleep again. I'm not sure that we're really going to see a radical paradigm shift here out of this around birth or death in the Biomedical Empire book, because I did want to keep it short. I just focused on the gates of life.
Okay. Yeah.
Because whatever might have happened to you in life, you're coming in and you're going out. And basically, the gates of life are surrounded by a hospital parking lot. You're expected to come and go. And the way that COVID affected that was to let a lot of people see some of the horror of that. But I really don't know that that has the power to eventuate real social change. Probably some cleaning up of the act is the best we can hope for.
Okay. What makes it a big pivotal moment? Because I know with financials and economics and the societal collapses, it's the feeding, it's the basic survival things. What do you see in the medical service industry? What makes a massive healthcare system reform? What makes it where people say enough is enough? What's that breaking point? Have you seen anything in history, or like, I'm just curious because I know it well on the financial macroeconomic side.
Honestly, this is a capitalist planet.
Yeah.
And what makes something actually come in is when it makes money. So, okay, doulas, that's a great idea. You can hire one more person. She can hold your hand, talk, be nice. I've heard people say things like, whatever horrible story happened, they took the baby away because I was being uppity and put it in the neonatal nursery. Just because they were, I was being an uppity black woman, and I never could have gotten through that without my doula. Woohoo, let's get more doulas. So I think when something works economically in the interest of the industry,
Then
sure,
it'll
let's
happen.
improve it. One more lower level worker with no power and no demonstrable skills other than being nice to people, is great. Let's add them, and then we don't have to change the work of the higher paid workers. Actually, it got easier. They don't even have to bother to spend time with the woman. And we're seeing it in the world of midwifery. It used to be that the midwife dealt with the entire woman. Now, basically, we got one person for her head and her hands, and I'll just deal with her birth, meaning her belly. And you've done some of the same disrupt the connectivity. And we talk about, work-life balance for the midwives. I get it, I get it, I get it. But really, what you're looking at here is economically advantageous. So it's happening. Birth doulas, death doulas, whatever. Is it changing the system? No. If you can think of something that will be profitable, you can change the system. If not, good luck with that.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's the challenge with midwifery is we got less interventions, better outcomes. There's less epidurals, there's less complications, there's less NICUs. I mean, those are all revenue streams. If you don't need all these lab work and extra testing and all these things, that's the revenue, that's the business side that makes it very difficult to counteract.
Yeah, on the one hand, we talk about saving money, not spending it, but that's money not made. So this is capitalism. Money's supposed to keep transferring hands every minute, most of it going upward. When you do something that disrupts that, it might not work so well.
Makes total sense. Makes total sense.
That
So
makes no sense, but
I mean, as
you are
far as
dealing.
like the incentive drive of like, yes, like, because it's always interesting because my perspective and my innocent world is capitalism is what has the best value is going to get out there. But if the system is so much higher up
That's
where
never what
it's,
capitalism was about.
no.
Never. It was about making money, not about value. You know that phrase, the customer is always right? It makes it sound like, oh, for patient customers. That was invented by a store owner who was controlling his workers. It's not what you know, it's not what you think that matters. It's the purchaser. Please the purchaser, and we're good. So it was never about empowering the customer. It was about controlling the worker. And that's what we're looking at, okay? And we're seeing it in the professoriate. It's become an issue. You know, the students control everything. It's in the interest of the larger institution, which increasingly are profit-making institutions. You see it in hospitals. You see it in every arena that it's about, capitalism is about profit. It's not that complicated. That's what capital is. And so if there's a world capitalist empire around medicine, medicine is going to be around profit. End of discussion.
Interesting. Very interesting. Well, I appreciate your time. I would love to spend the last 5 to 7 minutes just kind of doing a summary conclusion, words of inspiration. I feel like we have so many challenges that sometimes people on a basic level feel like, okay, this bigger system is just so broken. Its bigger system has so many variables. What can I do? What can I do to help make shifts? What can I do for making a better future for our children? I would love your input with what you're seeing.
I'm not good at hope on the larger scale. I don't do optimism. My brother said to me one day, I don't remember what the issue was, but Barbara, the glass, think of it, half full. And I said, Chip, it's a glass. It's going to fall off the table and break anyway. What difference does
You've
it
already analyzed the pessimism of the analogy. I love it.
loved it. It was best, one of the best lines I ever came up with, and it just popped out. So anyway, I don't know how to think optimistically, but I'm talking structurally. What I'm watching is individually, people are doing good things as best they can in an ugly, oppressive system. Pick the most ugly, oppressive system you've ever seen, slavery, the Holocaust. There were people who were doing good. Somebody ran the let the slaves stay in their basement on their way. Somebody hid people in their attic. I mean, there were people who did individual good. It did not change the Holocaust. It did not change slavery. Maybe a few more people survived. Maybe they eventually raided that attic. Goodbye, Anne Frank. But people did good and left messages to other people about being good. I often think of ideas are like in my books or ideas I raise are like messages in bottles. They're out there. Somebody someday might need it and see it. So I don't know how to talk about how to make the revolution. I really don't. I don't know how to make the
You
revolution. I
just
don't
see
think
the system and you're leaving it to someone else to figure out
I'm not
the
leaving to
angle.
someone else. I'm
So.
saying I don't know that there is a way of making a revolution against the forces of capitalism. I really don't know that that's possible. On the other hand, I think it is possible, and midwives are specifically among my heroes in the world who are actually doing it at the one-on-one level. Yes, this is a horrible, ugly capitalist medical system. Let's just lean on the door and not let the intern in for 10 minutes. Yes, this is a horrible, ugly capitalist system, and it would be much better if I could turn you into a high-risk patient. But actually, what if I just gave you a glass of orange juice? Or apple juice, whatever that woman had said. That you're making change. Many years ago, I think I will end with this. Many years ago, I was working on the genetics issues, another area of research and prenatal testing and the eugenics movement and la la la. And it was hard and I was miserable. And I was at one genetics meeting where a lovely young man, I talked to him, he had a kid, nice guy, said to me, he got up and said to this audience at the UN about why we had to patent the human genome. He said, otherwise there will be no incentive to cure cancer. And I said, huh, wait, let me think. Could anybody here think of another reason you might want to cure cancer besides profit? We're living in a world in which profit is the only motive that works. There's no way to cure cancer without profit.
Financial gain, yeah.
But individually, do we want to make change? So anyway, I was in that world and miserable. And then I went to some midwifery meeting and I was there and I just felt my shoulders relax. And a midwife I don't even know came up, gave me a hug basically, and said, you just look at home here. And this is home. I went in, there was a book area and selling stuff. I don't know if you can see it on the screen, a ring. The midwife's hands. I put it on and I have worn it for whatever this is, 20 something years since. I am committed to midwifery as a way of creating good in an evil world or an evil system.
Oh, I think those are wonderful words to end on, Barbara. Thank you so much for your time. And hopefully the midwives, I'll make sure if there's any questions or comments that I'll forward them to you and see if
Yeah,
we
I'm
can.
easy to find. If people want to write to me, it's not hard to find me. So email or whatever. Yeah.
And we'll put at the bottom your website and all your wonderful books. And I
I better go update
appreciate
that
update it before everybody gets there. I would love to see your newest book on there for sure. So thank you so much for your time today, Barbara.